right to the edge of this. Maybe I will never quit. Right, cause you're feeling it. Push it, push it, push it.
The aim of this podcast episode is to give new racers an introduction to and experienced racers a refresher on the rules and the spirit of the race and the ethos and history behind Lost Dot races and what it means to race a truly self-supported race. We have also asked the community to send in some specific questions for us to dive into, and we'll do that in the second half of the episode together here. So I'm sitting here with Andrew Phillips and Hannah Larbalessier. And before we get started, it's obviously important to mention, and especially for those who don't know, that all of these foundations and the things we're going to talk about today are based on our late founder Mike Hall's vision for the race. And they're the kind of things that we want to uphold, and we feel like it's our responsibility to do so, and we do our best to do that. So saying that, do we want to dive into what it does mean to race a truly unsupported race, and also even broader than that, what Mike Hall said about why race?
Yeah, I think there's two things there to start with. Why race and why race unsupported. And the why race, everyone's motivations are their own, but ultimately it kind of pushes us to do things we couldn't otherwise do. Mike talked about a sort of powerful cocktail of adrenaline and the way he was able to go places out on the trail when he was racing that he simply couldn't whilst touring. For me, racing is about, it's about finding how strong we are as individuals, and the competition of racing against other people allows us to really push the envelope on that. If we're just touring, if we're on holiday, if we're out on a day ride, then we can't go as deep as we can when we're racing. We just don't have the motivation. And then that requires a framework, the rules, which mean that you are all racing on the same page. You're all racing to the same standard. You know that the person behind you and the person in front of you are both racing to the same set of rules, which means that that competition between yourselves is valid, is measurable. So that's why we race, that's why we need rules. We can push ourselves further like that.
And I guess also the self-supported element of it is a very big part of that. And Mike's vision was really for a race that it's almost like the antithesis to modern cycling or modern competitive cycling, where you've got convoys of race vehicles and mechanical support teams and a huge amount of budget that goes into letting people perform at the best level. And self-supported racing strips that cycling right back down to its roots, and it means that you don't need a huge budget in order to be competitive, and you should be able to go out on the race and be completely self-reliant. And in order to make that a level playing field, those rules are there to ensure that people only access the same services and the same support that everyone else receives.
I feel like, especially for you guys as race directors, right? I'm there and telling the stories, but you guys are there, like, you know, making the calls and upholding this stuff that I feel like it's just really important. And I feel like because we're upholding something that someone else set out, it feels extra special. And we use that term, like, that we're standing on the shoulders of, you know, Mike. It does really feel like that. So I think I was pausing because it feels important, and it feels it's an honor to do that, I think, is what I'm trying to say. I'll stop getting so sentimental there.
It's worth saying, so none of us knew Mike, but we are continuing the race as we hope that he would have liked to have seen it continue. And sometimes that, often that is very guided by all of what he said when he wrote down the rules and the spirit of the race, and you might have come across an article that he wrote called This Is Not a Tour, which also goes into the ethos of self-supported racing and is really worth reading. So I'd recommend Googling it if you haven't read it. But the way that he set out the rules was very visionary and has really kind of shaped the sport of ultra racing, and most other races these days are really based on how he set out that ethos and the rules of the race.
Where I think Lost Art races are set apart from other races, and other races have adopted this sort of system for categorizing how different people race, and that is the general classification and what it means to versus what it means to have a race finish. Do you want to unpack what the general classification is and why a rider might want to go out of their way to make sure that they're in it?
Yeah, so basically the way that the rules are set out is that there are 10 rules to abide by, which you must follow those rules in order to achieve a race finish. And then we have some additional criteria which you have to satisfy if you want to receive a general classification finish. So a general classification finish is seen as like a finish with honours, and it's shown that you have ridden your race to the highest degree of self-support. You haven't received support from anyone else during that time. You've continued to ride within the classification that you started. So if you started as a solo rider, you finish as a solo rider. And you've ridden the whole race in its entirety alone. And the third way to receive a GC finish is to also make sure that you have validated at all of the control points along the course during their times of operation, so within the general classification time cuts. And so if you don't do those three things, then you can still receive a race finish, which is still highly prestigious, but a GC finish is just one step above that.
So a rider who doesn't make the time cut could still race for a race finish.
Exactly.
Or ride for a race finish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the general classification was brought in after TCR number 2, when two riders who actually ended up getting married later on in their lives started as solo riders and finished basically as a pair, having ridden together. And at the finish, Mike told them that they couldn't receive a full race finish. He hadn't at that point established the general classification. Now they were okay with it because they'd fallen in love and that was compensation enough, but then at the start of TCR number 3, he set out in advance that there would be race finish, which is sort of the default. If you don't break the rules and you finish the race, you get a race finish. But to those who want to and are able to hold themselves to a higher standard, and to be able to, as Hannah said, meet those extra criteria, having ridden truly self-supported, having met all of the time cuts, and having started and finished within category, i.e. remained solo or remained a pair, then those riders are able to finish with honours. There is potentially a higher standard of proof demanded from those riders that they have adhered to all of the rules and met those criteria for the classification. So for a race finish, we would, in order to take a race finish away from someone, we would need explicit evidence that they had broken one of those rules. Whereas for a general classification finish, if there is a suggestion that the rider hasn't followed the rules, we may require proof from them that they have. Okay, when there's a scenario where there is doubt involved. So an example of this might be pairs riding. If your dot is moving along with another rider's dot for an extended period of time, then you might want to think about creating evidence that you're not riding together. So Christoph Strasser was a really good example of this at the finish of TCR number 9. He had photos showing that he was not riding with Robin Gempela. Another example of this might be using banned roads. If you have specifically plotted your route knowing that there's a footpath behind a barrier next to a banned road, your tracker might not be accurate enough to show that you're not on the banned road, but you might want to take photo or video to show that you're not. So for those people who are really holding themselves to that higher standard, they might want to gather extra evidence to show that they are remaining compliant with all of the general classification rules at all times.
Nice. Yeah, that was a good synopsis. I think before we go down any rabbit holes, because there are many that we could go from here, that we should just dive into the rules. And this is something that, or these are something that the race director at the start of every race, after registration, at the rider briefing, goes through with all the riders all together in a big space. And yeah, it's usually quite, it marks a special moment for the riders because they've got there, they've got to the start line, and they're about to embark on the race that they've been training for however long in their preparation to get there. So yeah, we're going to do that right here, right now on the podcast for you guys. And yeah, hopefully it's helpful and we'll unpack them a little bit as we go and dive into some other sort of like more common questions we get about them afterwards.
Do you want to do the honors?
Yeah. Rule number one, ride from start to finish via controls listed here. That is a fairly self-explanatory one. The controls are in the brevet card. And so are the parkour. You have to ride them all.
And hopefully by this point, riders are well aware of them all and have plotted their route to all of them.
Yep, although some riders do miss controls every race, so make sure that you are visiting all of the control points on your ride, that you've got them all plotted on your route.
And the parkour.
Number two, no third-party support, resupply or lodgings. That one, again, hopefully fairly self-explanatory. Everything should be commercially available. Obviously, there's loads of grey areas. We'll get into some of those later. But that's broadly what that means, commercially available services only. Number three, no drafting other than with your pairs partner. That one is super simple. If we see you drafting, you might well get disqualified. Number four, all forward travel must be self-powered. Basically, don't get a lift, don't get on a train, don't get on a bus, pedal your bike. Number five, travel by ferries only on approved routes. Approved routes will be listed in the race manual. Normally, this is direct river ferry crossings only. But sometimes, like in TCR number 11, when there was a ferry allowed across the Adriatic, and in TCR number 12, when Baltic Sea ferries are going to be allowed, there are some extra allowed ferries, but normally this is direct river crossings only. Number six, all riders must maintain evidence of their ride. That means that in addition to having your tracker on, you should be recording via your head unit all the time so that we can validate that later on. Number seven, inactive for 2+ days without contact equals scratch. So if you go dark on the map, we haven't heard from you in 2 days, we're going to assume that you've scratched. Number eight, no insurance, no helmet, no lights, scratch. So those three things are all mandatory, and if we catch you without any one of them, then we will DQ you. Number nine, riders must know and obey local traffic laws. Again, hopefully self-explanatory, and also obvious why it's important. Number 10, ride in the spirit of self-reliance and equal opportunity. Now, this gets into the spirit of the race, gets into doing the right thing, not because someone's watching, but because you know that everyone else on the race is doing the right thing. It means stopping at that traffic light in the middle of the night, even though you know there are no cars, but you're doing it because the rider behind you and the rider in front of you are doing the same thing. So because we have a race that's spread out across an entire continent, it's incredibly important that riders are following the rules because they understand the power of them. So that's about the spirit of the race, knowing that it's not because they will definitely get caught for something, but because it's the right thing to do and it's what gives the race and ultimately the whole sport meaning.
And the spirit of the race is really, it's kind of starting to delve into that grey area as well, when things aren't necessarily listed in the rules, but if there's something that you're wondering, is that within the rules or should I be doing that? You can normally just give it a sense check and think, am I getting an unfair advantage over my competitors by doing this? Would my competitors be annoyed that I had taken this opportunity when it might not be there for them? And if that's the case, then you probably shouldn't be doing it. But there's some good literature by Mike, which you can find on our website if you look at the Spirit of the Race page, which goes into a lot of the common scenarios that racers might come into when they're racing, and gives some kind of in-depth talk about that. But I guess that's a good segue. Sorry, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, and that's a really good point. We have the 10 rules. There's a lot of reading around that you can do on the website. There's a lot of discussion in forums. There's a lot of there are Mike's YouTube videos that you can watch. You can read through all the race manuals. So it's not those. The idea behind the 10 rules is that a race like this has an almost infinite number of possibilities of things that could happen out on the road. And some riders might say, oh, but you don't have a rule for that. You don't have a specific rule for this. Some riders want to know exactly how long they can ride with someone else. Some riders want to know exactly what kind of transport they can take if their bike breaks a certain distance from a bike shop and it's a certain mechanical problem, etc., etc., etc. It's just not possible to create a 1,000-page rule book that covers every scenario. And even if it was, it would create far too many rules for people to actually follow accurately, and the whole thing would become a farce. So we have these 10 rules, and these boil down the most essential things that we have to adhere by. And then beyond that, there will always be a lot of interpretation, a lot of race director's judgment. It will always be based on these rules, but there's a lot of sort of lore that sits around that.
Yeah, it's definitely worth saying that, like, in 99% of circumstances when riders have a question about the rules, normally it's listed or it's answered in this literature that we've got on the website, but obviously it doesn't always fall under that scope. And so during the race, sometimes if someone has a question about their situation, they can contact the rider communications manager, who might be able to give them a straight answer, or he might communicate with us as the race organisers, and we end up having to have a discussion amongst ourselves and having to make a decision about this particular scenario that might never have happened before. And so it's not always a clean-cut answer, and often we just have to approach the question with, are they getting an unfair advantage by doing this? And that's normally... Yeah, that's the question that we have in our minds when we're thinking about this particular situation.
Yeah, I guess it's maintaining that level playing field is the ultimate goal. And I think it's also worth saying that as much as, you know, the community looks to us to entrust us to uphold the rules and maintain all of that integrity, that we also just as much look to our community to do the same. So yeah, it's a two-way street, and I think that it's important to remember that we're not just the holder of these rules, and that we want to follow them so that everyone is on the same level, which is, yeah, the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
Great. Are there a few that you wanted to go back and dive into?
I think maybe we should dive into the questions now.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, let's do it.
Sweet. Okay, so we've had a good few questions about interactions with other riders. You have already answered this. Someone just said, how long is it okay to ride with someone else? Which you basically just said should be... become obvious after a certain amount of time. I remember reading somewhere that Mike had said something along the lines of, like,
you know, as soon as it becomes long enough to be a date.
Anything more than dinner's a date.
That's what it is, yeah. Which I really like, because no one, you know, how long is that?
I've never heard that one before.
It's really good, isn't it?
To me.
Yeah, as soon as you're on a date with somebody, like, you need to break it off. Which makes sense, because, like, you know, we do really care about the social aspect of the race, and seeing another rider on the road is a really special experience, and saying hello to them and having a chat is totally fine, for the record. I've got someone else in the same vein that has asked, can I share food or buy a rider a drink? Do you guys want to unpack that one?
Yeah, so this one really comes down to, I think, whether you're doing it as an opportunity at a resupply point, when both of you would be able to access that food or drink anyway, or whether it's happening out on the road when you might be in need of food and drink and someone is giving that to you to help you out. Yeah.
Especially so, if they don't have cash and it's a cash-only situation, that wouldn't be okay. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. So if you're at a resupply point, let's say it's cash-only, one of you really needs some sugar or some food, and the other person is able to give the cash to help you achieve that, then you're getting support from that other rider. You're getting something that you otherwise wouldn't be able to access. And that was quite a famous situation on TCR number 8 with Coatgate when... Do you want to tell the story?
Christoph Strasser and Ulrich Bartholomus were at a petrol station in Bulgaria, or maybe it was Romania, together, and basically Christoph had just resupplied and was about to leave. Ulrich had arrived and just ordered his drink, and he was asked for cash for his Coke. He didn't have it, and Christoph paid for it. Now, there wasn't really ever any question that either of these riders, who are both pretty upstanding citizens of the ultra cycling world, there wasn't really any question that either of them were looking to gain any advantage there. But the fact remained that in this specific situation, Ulrich should have had cash with him. And because he didn't, he was in a situation where, you know, he would have had to maybe cycle into town to a cash machine and then come back and pay for the Coke he just drunk, or something similar. And it just so happened that Christoph was there and paid for it for him. And you know, both riders did this very unthinkingly, not looking to break any rules. But, as you can see, there was an accidental advantage gain there, because the rider behind them maybe would have gained 10 or 15 minutes on Ulrich as he'd gone to a cash machine, for example. So even little things which we might think of as a, you know, just an ordinary gesture of sportsmanship or something that you do in every day of your life have potential repercussions for the race, because it wasn't just those two riders who were racing that day. It wasn't just Christoph and Ulrich out on the road. It was the riders in front of and behind them.
Also, the red ambulance can change your whole day. If you have a ice cold Coke on a ride, like, it could save your life.
We will be in there.
Thank you for that. Someone else has asked if you can share a room with another rider.
Yeah, this one, again, depends on context. So if two riders arrive at a hotel at the same time and they're stood at the reception desk and agreed to share a room there and then, fine, no problem. You know, they're splitting the cost of the room, but they've both arrived. There's equal opportunity there for each rider. That's not a problem. Where it would become a problem would be if two riders were riding next to each other and one said, oh, I'm going to go ahead to the town up the road and see if I can get a room. And the other rider said, can I share it with you when you get there? That would be a problem, because essentially those riders are acting as a team at that point. One is helping the other rider by getting there first, potentially getting the last room, and potentially taking space away from other riders who might be out there. Another scenario might be if someone, and this is, I think, even more clear cut, if you knew someone who was in the next town and you'd looked on the tracker and you'd said, oh, well, I can't find any rooms left on booking.com, but I can see that Dave is in the next town, I'll just text him and see if I can share his room. So that's quite a clear-cut example of how that starts to get very unfair, because it then becomes the rider with the most connections, or perhaps even just the most well-known rider, who then gets that advantage of being able to share a room with almost anyone. So if it's serendipitous, you're both there at the same time, no problem. If it's a planned action, then it becomes a problem.
Is it support if I get another rider to get a photo of me at resupply?
That's absolutely fine.
I didn't mean to laugh. Somebody asked that and we are answering it.
it's not giving you an advantage on the race. It's just having a photo taken.
And we'd love for you to have memories of the race. And it's a totally normal interaction with somebody else.
And I think this does actually speak to something important, because this shows that our reputation for upholding the rules has been sort of overinterpreted with some people. You know, we are not looking to penalise riders. If something doesn't give you an advantage and it feels okay, then it probably is. You know, something like this is just a very innocent everyday act, absolutely fine. We're not out to get you. Learn the rules, understand the rules, think about the rules, and then you'll think about the kind of things that we're looking for as well, and that will put your mind at ease.
I think that this next question is a good one. Off the back of that, someone's asking, what about if a rider is clearly in distress, exhausted, having a mechanical, or simply having a bad moment? Which, there's lots of different things there, but they're asking, you know, I would always stop to make sure they're okay, and what if that means helping them by lending them a pump, giving them some water or food, or offering information, or even just a hug and reassurance? There's so many things in there, but do you want to start picking out what's okay and what's not?
So, a hug and reassurance, yeah, go for it. I mean, someone is clearly going through a bad time on the race, and maybe they'll call their friends or family and be asking for support. Emotionally, if you're passing by and you just need to offer them some reassurance, go for it. And definitely check that they're okay. When it comes to offering information, that's when you start getting into like more of the obvious support areas, and you're then giving them something that they might not otherwise be able to provide for themselves. When you then get to the point of sharing food or water, or maybe even offering mechanical assistance, you're maybe like even overstepping the mark of what you should be doing. Because instead of just letting them come up with a solution themselves, you might just be offering them a very quick fix to their problem. And you might think you're saving their race by doing that. But realistically, they might be able to come up with a solution themselves if they're just left to their own devices for an hour, or maybe half a day even. Even if it takes that long for them to come up with a solution themselves, they might be thankful that they were able to actually resolve the situation without relying on other people and still be able to complete the race in a self-supported way.
Yeah, I would say the two main things here. One, safety absolutely comes first. If you're concerned about someone's safety, then stop and offer them assistance. If there is any scenario where that person may be in danger, whether that's from other people or whether it's because they're in danger of exposure on a mountainside, or, you know, absolutely whatever it is, then you should check whether they're okay and use your own judgment on their answers as well. And if you're concerned about them, you should get in touch with the race organization immediately using the rider comms manager number on the back of your Brevik card. So that's the first thing. Rider safety is paramount. Secondly, yes, just reiterate what Hannah said there, in that it is something that might, the way this question has been phrased by the person is that I want to do a good thing. It's in my nature to help people, and therefore I want to stop and offer my assistance. Whereas that, as Hannah said, that help is fleeting, right? you can fix a puncture and that might get them down the road, but it's not going to solve all their problems. The race, as we said at the start, why do we have the rules? It's about how finding out how strong we are as individuals. And if you fix someone's puncture, you're removing their ability and their right to do that themselves. So what might appear to be an altruistic act actually might be good for you rather than them. So we encourage it when you're out on a day ride or whatever. You know, we like our riders to be nice people and we really appreciate the fact that you want to help people. But just think about whether you are really helping them.
And in that situation, if it was help that wasn't necessarily needed but was provided, it might well mean that both riders were removed from general classification. Obviously, if you're providing support where it's really necessary and this other rider in distress is at the point of scratching or not finishing their race as a result of it, then if you give your support, then we might make a decision that it's not going to affect your race result, but it will affect theirs. But if you're providing support to them in a way that's not necessarily needed, that may well affect both of your race results.
I think some of the best stories that we get to tell about the race are when people have had to problem solve with, in the initial moment, seemingly no solutions, and then somehow, you know, bodge or cobble together some kind of answer, whether it's mechanical or otherwise. Those are the most inspiring stories that come out of the race. It's amazing to be able to share.
And then the memories people have afterwards, they're the times where people will say, wow, I didn't realize I could do this. And then I overcame that obstacle. So it really does highlight the importance of giving people the space to solve their own problems.
Yeah. And also just listening to you guys talk about this stuff, I think it's also important to say that, as we started saying at the beginning, that finishing in GC is an above and beyond option, and you guys are all consenting adults and you can choose to finish your race outside of GC if that's how your race goes, right? It's not a disqualification. It's not a mark against your name. It's not any of that stuff. And yeah, race finishes are just as exciting and worthwhile.
Still a huge achievement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have a few more topics to get through. So this one is interactions with strangers. Questions about trail magic and all that stuff, and someone else asking, can you cheer people on as they pass through your area? Obviously, but you guys maybe say a little bit about people coming to cheer on loved ones and all that stuff, and what's acceptable to accept from a quote-unquote trail angel.
Yeah, so by all means, please do go and cheer people on if they're passing through your area. We love seeing dot watchers out on the road, and it's amazing to interact with people out on the race route. It's pretty magical just meeting people who know about the race and who are like cheering on the dots as they go through. Please just be mindful about how you're interacting with riders. Don't ride along with them. Try and spread the love so that you're not just there for the front runners of the race, but also so that you're cheering on the mid pack and some of the people towards the back. And
an interesting one here is that we sometimes have some of our more well known riders asking us about their fans wanting to cheer them on, and this is something which is becoming more of an issue as the race grows and as people's online following grow. And the best thing to do there is to say, yes, by all means, come out and cheer me on, but make sure you stay out and cheer on some other riders as well. Because we don't want this to become, you know, just the fastest riders show and give them an added advantage which other less known riders might not have. So if you're a well-known rider, you've got loads of fans, or even if you're not a well-known rider but just a really popular one, then just tell your fans to spend a bit longer out on the road and cheer on those around you as well.
Nice.
Spread the love.
Yeah.
spread the love. Obviously, calling your family and stuff during the race is allowed. We've already talked about it.
Do we want to touch on trail magic first?
Or even just before that. So if friends and family want to cheer you on, want to interact with you a bit more, that is okay, but just sort of within limits. You know, if you're cycling through your hometown and you stop for 5-10 minutes to hug your parents and kiss your baby on the head, then that's all fine, and that is obviously totally more than fine. It's understandable, it's encouraged, we love to see it. We had a beautiful instance of Julian and Simon cycling through Julian's hometown of Saint-Jean-de-Luz on the race last year, and there were some lovely photos there.
Homemade signs,
yeah. So that is, you know, how could you not do that? But if those people want to see you more than once on the race, or want to interact with you a little bit more, or something like that, then that's better done at a control point. Basically, if there's anything that might call the rider's race into question, do it at a control point, because then it's in a controlled environment. Our volunteers are there, our race teams are there, we can all see that nothing untoward is going on. Otherwise, you know, there is a chance that the riders either side of you might see what's going on and think maybe that there's a little more than just a hug being passed or that kind of thing, and you wouldn't want suspicions about your race. You wouldn't want people wondering whether you had raced a clean race. So in order to hold yourself to that higher standard, then that kind of stuff is better at control points.
And just to reiterate that, we really we would not look too kindly upon people who are maybe following along in a car, hopping from place to place to cheer people on, riding along like on a bike to accompany them. That kind of thing is when it starts to go against the rules. So like single interactions or interactions at control points, that's all great, we encourage it, but beyond that it's a bit too much support, really.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Trail magic.
Yeah, what is trail magic?
So trail magic is basically the interaction you might have with a stranger whilst racing, and that might be you know, just a hiker or a guy in a car at the top of a climb giving you a Mars bar or offering you a bottle of water, and broadly that's okay, so long as that person is not there because of the race, as long as they don't know the race is going on. They're not out to give riders support or assistance, then that is broadly viewed as trail magic and probably okay. If you really want to make sure that that there can't be any possible questions about your race, then you might not want to accept that anyway. And where it's certainly not okay is if you know that person, or that person knows you, that person is specifically there because of the race. So again, we're talking about well-known riders. If you're if you're a famous cyclist with 100,000 followers on social media, you could potentially have someone on top of every climb on the TCR with a bottle of water. And that obviously wouldn't be okay. So you shouldn't be accepting anything that has been brought there for you specifically. It might be okay to accept something that is purely serendipitous, it's only chance. But again, if you want to hold yourself to the highest possible standard and have no questions asked about your race, you might not even want to accept that.
I was told by a very diligent rider after TCR number 10 that someone had offered him an apple, and he didn't want to decline the offer because it was such a kind gift from a stranger, but he also didn't want to benefit from it. So he carried that apple for 3 days until he got to the finish and he ate it there.
Oh my gosh, I love that so much.
And let's be honest, he could have eaten that apple absolutely fine. That we would not have had a problem with it.
He was just very diligent.
He was very diligent.
Right, yeah. Amazing. Any other comments about serendipitous interactions? Okay. Interactions with family and friends at home. Digitally, mostly. So, yeah, we've said that it's totally fine to make phone calls and give updates and stuff on how you're doing to your loved ones. Make sure that they know you're okay. What somebody's asking is, can your family members check where you are in relation to other riders and tell you about it and also give you updates on things like the weather and stuff that's coming up ahead of you?
So it really depends on how this is delivered. If you are requesting that information from your friends and family to help assist your race, then it's really verging on the territory of having a race manager, having someone to provide information and support you that might influence how your race goes. So if you know that there's someone sleeping 2 kilometres up the road from you and you're on the way into the finish and your family members are calling you to be like, quick, wake up, you can overtake this person and get to the finish before them, then that's really not allowed. That goes against the race rules. We'd encourage you to explain to your friends and family that you don't want these kind of updates during the race, just to make sure that you are riding a very clean race. But obviously sometimes people are going to send you messages being like, you're doing so well, you've just caught this person who you're racing, and you can't always stop that kind of thing. But yeah, my advice would be to have an honest conversation with anyone who's going to be sending you messages during the race and just say, I don't want information updates, but please send me messages of support and encouragement.
Yeah, maybe we should be slightly clearer on that, that your friends and family should not be telling you what's going on the race. They shouldn't be telling you where other riders are. They shouldn't be telling you what the weather is. They shouldn't be telling you where resupply is, what towns are ahead, how many miles you've done, what average speed you need to get to a ferry, all those kind of things. You should not be getting information from anyone, basically. And yes, we understand that sometimes people will text you or message you on Instagram or whatever, and you can't necessarily be expected to stop all that. But your friends and family, you should tell them before the race that you don't want any of that information, and that kind of information could get you into trouble and could get your race result called into question. So yes, it's fine to chat with them, although, you know, even that is a sort of modern phenomenon. In early days of racing, people didn't call home, you know, before the days of data and minutes and roaming. And when it started to become a thing, there were a lot of people who said, you know, I'm not going to do that. James Hayden at TCR number 3 notably said that he wouldn't be doing that. And for him, that became support. You know, Michael famously took a burner phone on Tour Divide with him because he wanted to be truly self-supported. So, you know, for some people, even calling home is a form of support. It's not one that we police, because, you know, realistically we just can't, and it's something that does happen. But yes, you definitely shouldn't be receiving any information from them which is relevant to the race.
Okay, so let's talk about some pre-race stuff, when riders are planning the routes and deciding how the race is going to go. Someone asks, what kind of information about my preparation can I share on social media before the race? Route planning is forbidden, but what about my bike setup, sleep strategy, diving into all those kinds of things?
Yeah, I guess it's good to reiterate here that it is against the rules to share any information about your route planning. So sharing information on how far your route might be, or how much elevation you're doing on your route, or places that you're visiting on your route, any sort of details like that is against the rules. You should make sure that any routes that you're planning are private and not listed publicly on your route planning software. Because mostly you don't want to be giving away all of your hard-earned secrets and all of that work that's gone into your route planning. We enjoy having a huge diversity of routes on the race. It's one of the things that's really special, especially about TCR. Sharing other things, and sharing tips on route planning, we encourage. So sharing tips on how you might use different software to make sure that your route doesn't go onto some of the banned roads. So TCR always prohibits a fairly large number of roads to keep the route as safe as possible. And so that is one of the challenging parts of planning a route, making sure that it doesn't go on any of these roads. And there's various workarounds that other riders might be able to suggest to you to make sure that your route stays on the safe roads. But yeah, we highly encourage sharing your bike setup, sharing sleeping strategies, maybe slightly different. Depends how closely you want to guard your race strategy. If you're going to be really competitive at the front of the end of the race, you probably don't want to give away tips like that. But if your sleep strategy is, you know, oh, I'm going to sleep 4.5 hours every night because I know that that's the right amount of sleep for me, go ahead, tell
your
mates.
We're not policing that.
We're not policing that. Share your tips for how to devise a sleep strategy and yeah, share your knowledge. I think it's really useful for anyone else getting into racing to understand how sleep strategies work and how they might find their own sleep strategy that works for them.
Cool. Can I have an AI bot as my race manager?
I think the answer here really depends on whether this bot is just doing research, in which case it's essentially a Google-type tool, maybe slightly more sophisticated, or whether it's actually taking agentic actions on your behalf, such as booking rooms, which would not be okay. So research, yes. Actions, no.
Okay, that's pretty clear. Do you have any more to say about AI before we move on? Because it is a big topic, but that was also a really good answer.
No, I think that's it. Let's cool. wait to see awesome. How it develops.
Yeah, okay. Someone has asked, can you use FMC, Follow My Challenge, to research riders' routes ahead of you and change your own route?
This one's easy as well. You can, but you shouldn't. It's frowned upon. Firstly, we can't actually stop you doing it. But you should be confident in your own route, because just because someone else has done something doesn't mean it's the right thing for you. You're there at a different time, different weather, different time of day. You're a different person, different rider, different bike. Don't do it. It's a stupid thing to do.
Another great answer. We have a little section on taking transport during the race. So if someone's bike breaks, can they take a taxi to a bike shop?
This is a bit of a grey area. You should really only be taking public transport. That's what the rules say. However, if there really is no public transport, there have been occasions when we've allowed riders to take taxis instead. There's also, depending on what part of the world you're in, sometimes a grey area between a taxi and a bus. So document what you do. Do your best to solve the problem in line with the rules as much as possible. So take a bus if you can. Then when you get to the bike shop, you ride back from the bike shop. As soon as your bike is fixed, you should be riding it. And don't think you can find a loophole by leaving your bike, taking a taxi or a bus, and then coming back for it, because really you should have your bike with you. So again, just be documenting everything you're doing in that situation so that you can explain it to us later. And try as far as possible to work within those fairly clear rules, which are take public transport and then ride your bike back to where it broke.
Okay. The next topic is jettison of kit. I've got a few questions, but the first question is, where is the red line in terms of equipment that cannot be jettisoned? Example, helmet, jersey, socks, emergency blanket, water bottle.
I guess it should be stated first that when you ride a self-supported race, you should be finishing the race with all of the kit that you started with. You shouldn't be jettisoning kit. You shouldn't be disposing of kit And you shouldn't be posting kit home or to the finish line so that you no longer have to carry it. Doing a race like this, you should have thought fairly long and hard about what kit you are going to need on the race. And you shouldn't be turning up to the race with more kit than you need and then realizing that your bike's a bit too heavy after a couple of days and wanting to get rid of it. So we draw quite a red line under kit jettison, but obviously there's a bit of a spectrum about what is disposable and what isn't. So helmet, like, obviously you can't post a helmet home, you should be wearing your helmet the entirety of that.
That's okay.
It's in the rules that you have to wear a helmet. So I guess if you broke your helmet and you had to replace it, at that point your helmet is no longer useful and it's okay to dispose of it, but you shouldn't be posting, you shouldn't be jettisoning a helmet otherwise. Kit, you shouldn't be jettisoning. I think for TCR particularly, even though we're going to be starting in a location that has colder weather than where it finishes, so we're going from Norway to Greece, you're still potentially going to need layers and cold weather gear going through Bosnia, Albania, Greece. You're still going to be high up in the mountains at times. And so I think if you take a layered approach, you take a down jacket with you, you take a waterproof jacket, you're not going to need a huge amount more than that for going through Norway either. So what you start with, you should be finishing with.
I think broadly most of this could be covered with, if you start with it, you should finish with it. If you break it on the race and you replace it on the race, then we understand that you might get rid of the first item. You might not physically have space to carry both. But that's basically it.
Yep. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, that makes sense. This person is asking about doing things in advance. And obviously, it's not allowed. We're not allowed to send ahead a package, you know, during the race. But they're asking how in advance it is okay to book hotels and accommodations, ferry crossings, etc. And also, like, calling a bike shop to see if they can have a certain part or tire or whatever ready for you when you arrive. So let's start with talking about how much in advance it's okay to book accommodation and ferries.
So it's actually for booking the first night's accommodation, you can book that up to 24 hours before the race starts. For any other accommodation that you will use during the race, you can only book it once the race has started.
Yes.
You should only be booking it when you're fairly certain that you can make that booking. So you shouldn't be booking several nights ahead if you're not sure you can get there on time. You shouldn't be depriving other riders or other competitors of a reservation by making that and then not turning up for that reservation. Equally, you should only be booking one hotel per night. You shouldn't be booking multiple places to hedge your bets on where you can get to. And the same applies for ferry crossings. You can make a ferry crossing reservation as soon as the race starts, but we encourage you to do it for when you know that you can make that crossing.
Yep.
Or get a flexible booking, which is often an option.
But again, not before race start.
Yeah.
Yep. And we might check for receipts.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. At the end of the race, our very diligent team of dot watching volunteers and race investigators go through rider results. And this coming year, they might be asking for booking receipts for ferries. That's right.
And the other question was, is it allowed to insure in advance whether a bike shop would have something in particular in stock?
Yeah.
So you could do that research in advance of the race. You could check whether this shop that you're going to pass has these tyres that you want, but you wouldn't be able to order them or purchase them before the race starts. So you couldn't leave a set of tyres at a bike shop with the intention of getting them installed during the race, you would have to purchase them during the race. Yeah.
You couldn't ask a bike shop to have them in for you. Right. You couldn't say, make sure you have a set of GP 5000 32mm on the...
Reserved.
Yeah, exactly, on the 27th of July.
Yeah. But you might make a phone call to a bike shop once the race has started.
Once the race has started, yeah. Fine, yeah. I mean, once the race has started, you can then call them and say, do you have GP 5000s? And they say no. You say, great, can you order some in, please? Will they get there before I do? That is absolutely fine.
Yeah. Yeah. What about warm showers for accommodation?
This is a funny one. Warm showers, for anyone who doesn't know, is like couch surfing, but for touring cyclists. And essentially, it's sort of a... It's somewhere between a private club and commercially available, although it's not commercial. So, broadly, we don't actually have a problem with people doing this because we don't think you're going to get an advantage. However, it's not the way that warm showers works. I've been a warm shower host and a warm shower guest many times, and warm showers is all about sitting down with your host, cooking them dinner, sitting there all evening by the fire, having a lasagna and a couple of glasses of wine, and swapping stories from the road. And if you can't do that, if you're not willing to do that, then you're probably not a very good warm shower guest. And your host certainly won't want to let you in at 3 a.m. and let you out again at 6 a.m. So it's not really recommended, and it would certainly be a problem if it then turned out that your warm showers host was also a friend or someone you knew.
Right. So we're advising against it, unless you can provide a somewhat human interaction.
Yeah, it's just not... it doesn't really work with the race. Mm. You could try it. You won't get any advantage from right. it.
Yeah. Or removal from GC. But it just might not be great.
Now. Yeah, and you'll probably also trash your warm showers rating.
Okay, there you go. You heard it here first. What about if it's my own front door on the race route, and this person is specifically saying and asking... why wouldn't it be okay for me to stay in my own accommodation when I pass my front door and, you know, not pay for a hotel 10 minutes down the road because I'm just trying to save money?
And they say, especially since I'm only racing against myself and not for a podium spot, it simply means I'm saving money. So in this situation, I would say, I understand that you might not be feeling competitive against the other people in the race, but that doesn't mean they're not feeling competitive against you. And the whole point of doing a race is that you are on a self-supported adventure, and there should be a level playing field between you and your competitors, regardless of how far down the ranking you are. So it's not about how you feel about your race, but it's about respect for your competitors as well. And so in that situation, you are gaining an unfair advantage. You're taking yourself out of that race scenario that we've described before about how the race does take you to a different place than if you're just touring. And why would you want to take yourself out of that that race scenario and to go back into the comfort of your own home? It's also going to be a struggle in the morning when you have to leave and bring yourself back into that race mindset.
It's a clear unfair advantage, isn't it? Anyone who can stop off at their own house on the race has an unfair advantage, and that's kind of all we need to say on that. It's clearly not allowed.
And the same would go for stopping at a mate's house as well.
Yeah. However, we do understand that that's going to be very frustrating for you. So sorry, but no, you can't.
Okay, so the children of the streets of Essaouira have stopped playing their football on the streets. Thank you for enduring those noises, those background noises with us. Hopefully they added some flair to our conversation. I think the last thing that I want to say before we totally wrap up is the fact that maybe about half of these questions, I'm sure you guys will agree, could have been answered by reading the race manual, which is something that more than you would think, riders don't actually do very thoroughly. And if you would like to, you know, stay in our good books, then maybe before emailing or messaging us a question that you may have about the race, and you are the rider of this race, if you could read the manual, I think our race directors would be eternally grateful. Am I right?
You are right. Yeah, I would say if you got a specific question, read the manual. If you just want to learn more about the rules, read the manual, follow the links, go to the Lost Dot Spirit page, watch Mike's YouTube videos. If you do all that kind of stuff, you understand what kind of things we're looking for, why the rules are why they are, and you'll be able to interpret them yourself in a sensible way, and it'll all make sense to you. So demystify the rules, go and do your own research, do your own reading, and really understand what they are, why they are, and how we enforce them.
But also, we are here to answer your sincere questions. And do please email us if there is something that, you know, we didn't touch on this podcast and that you can't find the answer out for yourself. And we'd love to, yeah, continue to, yeah, educate our followers and riders and welcome you into, yeah, our races in the future, hopefully.
Yeah, and finally, just a thank you to everyone who did submit questions. There were a lot of good questions on the grey areas, and it was fun to actually go through them and have a chat about where we thought the line was with a lot of these questions. So thanks for getting in touch, and we're looking forward to seeing you at a race soon.
High, ocean deep, heart so wild, can't be beat. A way to find the light.